And today I must begin to talk about the Jewish religion itself. And when I talk about the Jewish reaction itself, I am also talking at the same time about what was left of liberalism. Because as we have talked about communism and socialism on the one side in their attitude towards the Jewish question, and fascism and national socialism on the other side and their attitude towards the Jewish question, we have really dealt with those ideas which attracted the majority as the radicalization became more extreme in the 1920s. And that liberalism with which Jewish faith was so much bound up ever since the 19th century, that kind of liberalism survived above all within the Jewish community itself. So that when we talk about the reaction of Jews now to National Socialism and eventually to the new Europe National Socialism was creating, we are talking in effect about liberalism as well, and that you must realize from the very first. For the Jewish communities in Europe, in their majority, whether you think of Germany or France or anywhere in fact, were liberal even when liberalism was collapsing all around them. Indeed, this is where liberalism survived, as you will hear in short order. For by and large, these people voted liberal still till the very last. Their particular Jewish newspapers took a liberal stance, however that might be modified in the end. And this liberalism determined to a large degree their reaction to National Socialism, first in Germany and then in all of Europe. Even after the Nuremberg Law, the basic ideas, of course, was that National Socialism was transitional, that it certainly would not outlast the first winter, for winter brought on the most severe economic crises in the Depression. And even after the Nuremberg Law, the Nazi way of going slow seemed, of course, to reinforce this kind of idea. It is in 1936, for example, that the central organization of German Jews, called the Zentralverein, CV, the Zentralverein, the central organization of German Jews, issues this directive for Jewish behavior, 1936. Jews should impose upon themselves the greatest discretion. They should avoid public places of amusement, unnecessary walks, and stay at home as much as possible. In other words, detailed advice for discretion. And you will find this more or less all over Europe. For example, the French community issued very similar advices for their own members. The liberalism comes out especially strongly when Jews now have to withdraw into their own organization. After the Nuremberg Laws of 1934, a Jewish and separate school system had to be built up. A Jewish adult education and retraining program, Jewish sports clubs, and in fact, in all compartments of life, separate Jewish organizations had to be formed. The guidelines laid down by the central organization for all these Jewish separate organizations, from the school system on to everything else, always stressed that the diversity of worldview must be preserved. This basic liberalism ensures Jewish organization to such an extent that it, by 1936, raised a considerable problem. For it so happened that Jewish educational functions, adult education, things of that nature, were visited by an increasing number of Gentiles who found in these Jewish organizations the only preservation of a diversity of point of view in Germany. This became a considerable problem until in 1936, the National Socialist government had to lay down a law that Jewish organization must exclude Gentiles. Apparently so many Gentiles came to these functions that a law, and a very embarrassing law in one way or another, was actually necessary. In this preservation of the diversity of point of view, there are three factors that above all must be stressed. First of all, the devotion to liberalism, which I've mentioned. Second of all, the idea that the Nazis were transitory, which I have mentioned too. And thirdly, that I must add that one does not desert the fatherland in times of trouble. And these are times of trouble, but in times of trouble one does not desert the fatherland. In 1933, an overwhelming number of opponents of Nazi, not just the Jews, but other opponents of Nazi, believed that the Thousand-Year Reich would only be of short duration, and that indeed the main task of the hour was not to desert under these circumstances, under this kind of aberration. To be sure, later on you have a gradual shift, but always in terms of Nazi gradualism until 1938, which I have stressed before. What played a role, above all, if you examine Jewish education and Jewish adult education in that period, is this ethical monotheism that we have talked about so much with Reformed Jewry. That ethical monotheism, this belief in men, this stress on the prophets, above all in the adult education, the stress on the prophets, meant very clearly and ideologically that first catastrophe and then restoration. In the entire biblical story of the prophets, it is always first catastrophe, but it is always then restoration. Or, as you could put it otherwise, pessimism for the immediate future and optimism for the day after tomorrow. This essence of Reformed Judaism, which was of course the majority of Judaism, based on the prophet, is what actually infused Jewish educational efforts during the Third Reich, and which led, in a way, to a kind of idea of staying, an idea of staying power, an idea of seeing it through, if you like, an idea of seeing it through for a better tomorrow. This becomes very important, both in preserving the diverse viewpoints, and in giving Jews a kind of basic optimism, which you find, and you will always find, widespread in France as well, by the way, which I think must not be underestimated. For not only the Germans, but the French also reacted in the same way. Discretion on the one hand, optimism on the other. Optimism here, not only because of the prophets, but because of the old idea that France was the country of the Revolution and the Enlightenment, and that would be bound to reassert itself. So that French Jewish notables also counseled discretion, counseled modesty, not to put yourself forward, and indeed, in the end, seeing it through, as it were, in this way. The patriotism was as deep in France as in Germany, as a reason. You do not desert the fatherland in times of trouble. This kind of a patriotism, of course, is also, from what I have said, easy to explain. Together with this, you must always remember what I shall remind you as we now go on quite often, that with this there was no basis for resistance, for the Jews were not a coherent community in the first place, either in Germany or in France. They had central organizations, to be sure, moderately effective, but by no means ideologically or otherwise coherent. But even in Eastern Europe, you find these kind of attitudes, which I have just explained. If you think back over your reading in the family Moscot, you will see that the Warsaw notables thought very similarly to the notables in Paris or in Berlin, in the way that I have just tried to explain. In other words, this was a general factor, to parts of which I will return later. What makes it especially interesting in Germany and elsewhere, that the liberal central organization, the Zentralverein, with its 60,000 members in Germany, was not alone. Side by side with that big liberal sort of roof organization, there existed rightist Jewish groups. Jewish groups which were not liberal. And their relationship with the Nazis and their eventual fate was, we might say, perhaps still more tragic. These groups within the Jewish community were on the right. And these must interest us, especially as no Jabotinsky-Mussolini relationship was, of course, possible. That was excluded from the first in National Socialism. The kind of relationship between Mussolini and Jabotinsky, which I talked about earlier. There were many small rightist groups, but what must concern us foremost, the most important of these groups in all countries, is the groups of war veterans, which in Germany were about 30,000. In France were also quite numerous. These groups of war veterans, that is, veterans of the First World War, were, of course, from the beginning, anti-Zionist, for the education of youth in military service and in national work service, what the Nazis later called Arbeitsdienst, national work service, but it was their program long before the Nazis took it up. They acted like all veterans' organizations, Christian or Jewish, after the First World War. They were patriotic, after all they had fought and suffered for the fatherland. The country into which they returned was no longer the country they had fought for. It was a country badly split in social disillusion, without any of the military virtues which they had learned to appreciate in the war. And so veterans groups generally became conservative pressure groups. They always do, and they always did. And that included the Jewish War Veterans Organization. The Jewish War Veterans Organization, therefore, from the first, tried to find an accommodation with National Socialism on a basis of equality. This must be seen from the perspective, not of our times, but the perspective of 1933. Veterans who, through their service in war, believed that they were owed a place in the fatherland. Veterans who listened to Hitler and the Nazis' exaltation of veterans of the First World War. Many of these Jewish veterans were highly decorated. For example, in May 1933, they pointed out to the government that in Italy, many Jews were the most loyal followers of the fascist state. From time to time, in the first 3 years of National Socialism, they gave to Hitler their confession of loyalty and readiness for service. This fell on deaf ears of Hitler, not on the deaf ears of the President Hindenburg till 1934, but on the deaf ears of Hitler, but deaf but courteous. In all of the National Socialist legislation on the Jewish question, exceptions were always made for Jewish war veterans, and especially for those who were highly decorated with the Iron Cross, first or second class. Meanwhile, the veterans' organization attempted to build up youth movements, which were soldierly in comportment, which in a sense adopted many of the fascist ways of doing things, and which, like all the veterans, attempted to draw a line between themselves and the East European Jews who had emigrated to Germany since the war. Now, all this is not really very astonishing. Veterans groups, as I have said, are always rightist pressure groups. You read about that in the Crisis book. And in France, Jewish war veterans had the same kind of attitude. For example, the organization known as the Patriotic Union of French Jews, Mr. Weinberg's favorite French organization, these Patriotic Union of French Jews had exactly the same idea. Accommodation was right, a division between them and the more recently emigrated Eastern European Jews, the emphasis on military discipline and military comportment, the emphasis on sports, above all on sports, because nobody does sports because he likes them. After the 19th century, as you well know, sports are always ideological. Nobody does sports because he likes them. Sports were, in other words, to transform the Jewish stereotype. That is what these sports were about. And what you have, therefore, are youth groups organized on this principle, both in France and in Germany. You are amused. I'll tell you something. I know a group of Jews right now here who play baseball with this in mind. So what you have therefore here, oh, that is quite clear. What you they are looking for, a war veterans organization, sponsor them. I said I would, but I am not, I haven't got the Iron Cross first class, for one thing. All I have is my father's Turkish orders, and they're not very good. So, what you have therefore here is understandable and European-wide. That, I think, must be made quite clear. There is no doubt, therefore, that for a great many Jews, in the years between 1933 and 1938, it was a matter of loyalty to Germany. And why not? They had gone through a dreadful war in the trenches. Why not? They had lost very often limbs and health in this endeavor. Why not? It was for them a matter of loyalty to Germany, regardless of the regime. And I must say again that even for the war veterans, the Nazi regime was regarded as transitional. transition. In all of this, then, the Jews were allowed their own organization. And indeed, at first it seemed that for the righteous groups, there was a basis of collaboration. And here we must put something else into the equation. The left wing of National Socialism, the SS around Röhm and Strasser, which had been very important as the more extreme National Socialist wing. The SA wing around Röhm and Strasser, whom Hitler murdered in 1934, were radical on the social question, but actually more moderate on the Jewish question. That is to say, the more radical they were on the social question, the more moderate they were on the Jewish question. And it is a fact that between 1933 and 34, before they were murdered in July 34, righteous Jewish organizations were in constant and sympathetic contact with groups around Röhm, especially with groups around Röhm. I can even go further than that. Rightist youth movements had common meetings with Hitler Youth, above all in the Berlin region. And until 1934, the Berlin Party allowed common sports events, with the proviso that these not be publicized too much. But they were allowed, because for that kind of Nazi, what they wanted was clean separation, and that is what they now had. The Jews were in their own groups, not in other people's groups. They had clean separation, and they confronted in the rightist groups, they confronted really patriotic organizations whose patriotism also believed in some of the basic Völkisch tenets. Not until 1934, not really until the Nuremberg Laws, was the separation made complete. And we must realize what isn't realized enough, the confusion even on the Jewish question in the early days of the National Socialist Party. For the Jewish youth movement, which was not Zionist, but linked to the veterans, supported by the veterans, the arguments were very simple and logical. These Jewish youth groups believe that Jews are one among the many tribes of Germany, that they are in Germany, let us say, like the Saxons, or the Bavarians, or the Rhinelanders, one among many tribes in Germany, but not more. Their leader, a man by the name of Schütz, who led the most important of these youth leagues, which I can't go into much detail. Schütz, for example, held quite clearly that Jews are no more. He said, outside religion, we have no peculiar Jewishness. Our heart beats only for Germany. We are in a historical community, in a common fate with Germany. Jewishness is in fact a religion. Here you have a climax of the development of assimilation, which I have discussed so much earlier, that Judaism was becoming a religion, but not more than a religion. Therefore, they were ready to serve a Germany. For Schütz and others, Judaism was, in fact, a kind of dialogue between the Jew and God, much influenced by Luther and Kierkegaard, a dialogue between the Jew and God, which was a spiritual dialogue, but had no political or social consequences, no more than the Saxons or Bavarians or Rhinelanders could be said to be other than Germans, though the Jews were a tribe with a spiritual religion, and that was all. This was an offer of collaboration, of course. And perhaps it might be better said, an offer of accommodation, of course. What strikes us here, I think, in retrospect, as partly reprehensible, is the concession of so much. The East European stereotype is, of course, conceded, and the line is very sharply drawn. A German patriotism, but again the flight from a stereotype now common in the land. Perhaps what seems to us so reprehensible is that too much was admitted. In a sense, the stereotype was admitted, the foreigners of Eastern European Jews was admitted. But let me make clear here something else so we get it in real perspective. No more was admitted towards National Socialism than socialist Jews admitted towards Marxism. No more was admitted here towards the one than socialist Jews admitted to the other. In fact, you can say that more Jewishness was in these rightist groups, at least they believe in a Jewish religion, than you have on the left with Jewish socialists who admitted still more, including the stereotype as well. So we must keep this in the perspective. And before you condemn it, because you are very fast to condemn from now on in, because you have never lived under such circumstances, you must never forget in what I said now, that those of you who are Jewish and live probably the most sheltered life any Jews have lived in Jewish history. Many of you don't even know what anti-Semitism is. So that it is very difficult for you to put yourself into the place of such a situation. That you must never forget. And therefore we must get the perspective here right as well. A deep patriotism, which is quite foreign for you as well. These Jews who were involved were German Jews or French Jews who had lived in their locality for centuries. It isn't like you. Most of you, let us say, have come to Scarsdale in the last 30 years, or to Racine in the last 50 years. But my family had lived in Germany since 1300 and in Berlin since 1500. There is a great difference here. And I want to make this clear, because again there, sometimes you lack the kind of perspective. You're not dealing with a mobile society. You're dealing with a settled society of which these Jews are an integral and settled part. That is something you must never forget. And from out of that, and the war experience, you must explain this kind of accommodation that Turks and others had, and that the French Jews had as well. You must explain it from out of this kind of context. And if you say that these Jews conceded too much to the enemy, then we must again say, so did everybody else, including the communists, you remember. For the argument was always on the territory of the enemy. That was the skill of National Socialism. That was the skill of anti-Semitism. And they conceded so much because, like everybody, the argument came from a territory designated by the enemy. These rightist organizations were, in a sense, isolated. Obviously, as time went on, they had less and less of a case. And they came in what was for them more and more threatening, isolation. Turks had to flee to Sweden because he had negotiated with Rome, Strasser. He had to flee to Sweden in 1935 and is now a professor at the University of Erlangen. But he had to flee to Sweden in 1935, and indeed more and more the liberals came actually to win the day. That especially after September 1933. In September 1933, the Nazis forced the Jews to unite in a single organization, an organization called the National Deputies, if you want to translate it that way. It's called the Reichsvertretung. That is the deputies of the Reich, the Jewish deputies of the Reich. The Reichsvertretung, under the leadership of what was then the most prominent and famous Berlin rabbi, to whom I shall come back anyway, Rabbi Leo Beck. The Reichsvertretung in 1933 became the central organization. And until 1939, this Reichsvertretung had some freedom of movement, restricted, but some freedom of movement. In 1939, it was taken over by the security police, or the direction was in effect taken over by the security police. The Nazi scheme was clear, and we will come back to it when we talk about the final solution. The scheme was clear and necessary. Jews were consolidated into one body, nominally under Jews, but from 39 on, controlled indirectly by the security police. This is perhaps the most important action for the later final solution, as you will see when I come back to it. It was a necessity for the final solution. But notice, what I want you to notice about it now is that this organization was a Jewish organization, headed by the most prestigious member of the Jewish community. And that it was controlled, but laxly, but then in 1939, it was the security police who in fact will tell them what to do, but never directly. As some of you know, throughout all the final solutions, the Nazis never told the Jews what to do directly, but always through other Jews. This was part of the system and a necessary part of its success. The first prerequisite and the model was the Reichsvertretung in Germany, to which were added later, as you will see, the so-called Jewish councils, or Judenräte, which is much the same thing as the Reichsvertretung in Eastern Europe. But to the Jewish councils to that development, we shall return. From the beginning, the orientation of the Reichsvertretung was liberal and in a way ambivalent. On the one hand, it encouraged emigration, but only half-heartedly. Its whole thrust until 1938, until September 1938, the Kristallnacht, the program I talked about, until September 1938 and the second stage of Nazi Jewish policy, the thrust was one of holding the fort until that too shall pass. And what that meant in practice are adjustments with a maximum of autonomy. That adjustment took many forms. Again, the Reichsvertretung asked Jews to vote yes on Hitler's plebiscite on withdrawal from the League of Nations. Officially, the Reichsvertretung asked Jews to vote yes. But even here in this, what was a vote for the government, after all, again, the objective situation is determinant. For as I have told you, why emigrate if you have lived there for centuries, and why not wait it out and do the best you can? This encouragement to vote yes in the plebiscite of 1933, this rules for discretion, for Jewish discretion, things were to tide you over to better times. It was, as the prophet would have said, the optimism for the day after tomorrow, which played a part there. And of course, a general idea, of which some of you are perhaps not foreign, that Jews should indeed not be in the public eye. That Jews in the public eye lead, in fact, necessarily to anti-Semitism and to Jewish elimination from public life. You may know that, and that is why I know a lot of people didn't vote for Goldberg in New York City for that reason. So that these ideas are, after all, plausible ideas in an age when the security that you kids have was unknown. I mean, I come back to that when I ask how many of you knew the protocols as the elders of Zion. There were a lot of you who never heard of it. Inconceivable. I was confronted with them when I was six, as a little toddler, part of the Jewish world conspiracy. To be sure, I gave the little blonde girl who did this a kick, some be nameless. But still, I was confronted with this from the age of six. And you have never been confronted with it. So you must always get the perspective right. That's why I labor it. You have been in a perhaps fool's paradise. I think so myself, for what it's worth. But you live in a fool's paradise in this regard, of course. Now the Zionist position was more complicated, much more complicated, and perhaps for that reason, interesting. On the one hand, the Zionists seemed to take a straightforward step. In 1934, there appeared a famous editorial in the Berlin German Zionist Weekly, Jüdische Rundschau, written by my old friend Robert Weller. A famous editorial which said, "Carry with pride the yellow star." That famous editorial, and that was quite daring at the time, I might say, "Carry with pride the yellow star," is one side of the coin. But the other side of the coin comes in a long memorandum to Nazi government officials from the German Zionist organization, a memorandum dated June 1933. In that memorandum, it is pointed out to the Nazi official that the Zionists also wanted to prevent an intermixture of German and Jew. As the memorandum put it, the Zionists wanted to prevent a mixture of nationality and blood. But here again, we must see this Zionist memorandum within the objective reality. Its purpose was to encourage help from the German government for the purposes of emigration to Palestine. In that purpose, the Zionists went one step further. In 1933, they negotiated with the Nazi government what has come to be known as the famous transfer agreement. And that agreement laid the foundation, much of the foundation of present Israel economics. The transfer agreement. What is this agreement? It is an agreement that with immigrants, German capital could be transferred to Palestine in return for purchase of German goods. This transfer agreement, capital to Palestine in return for the purchase of German goods, came into the Jewish community like a bolt of lightning. Why? Because it broke the boycott of Germany economically, which world Jewry, and especially American Jewry, had tried to initiate. From 1933, there was in America and Europe an attempt by world Jewry to initiate an economic boycott against Germany. The Zionists broke this economic boycott and broke it spectacularly. Now there are two things that must be separate. First of all, the boycott was never effective. I remember well in France how my sister used to go around to find nylon silk stockings that weren't made by Bamberg in Germany. But all that happened is that the French merchants put another label on it. It's like the grapes during the grape strike, remember? Madison merchants called them grapes from Chile or Peru. They just had different labels on it. So the boycott, of course, wasn't successful in the least. I remember the distress when one usually found out that one had gone to 60 shops not to buy German goods, one ended up with German goods anyhow, under a different label. So that is the first thing that must be said. But the second thing that must be said, that it was vital to an emigration, which was a failure. Till 1938, a tiny amount of Jews emigrated to Israel, to Palestine, hardly worth mentioning. It was an attempt to give an uplift to an emigration which was an utter failure. Why did the Germans do it? For the Germans, it broke the boycott, and broke it very effectively. For you could now say, why are you boycotting us? The Zionists have made a capital transfer agreement with us. Very effectively. And that is really why they signed the agreement. The German consul in Tel Aviv put it very nicely, I think, at the time in a memorandum to the German Foreign Office. World Jewry torpedoed from Tel Aviv. That was the German. The German view of the matter. But the Germans, of course, abrogated it in 1938. And why did they abrogate it? Again, for what we might call very good reason. For suddenly in 1938, there were 200,000 Jews more, namely the Jews of Austria, who had come into Germany with the Anschluss. So there were more Jews, and the transfer agreement in that number might have dangers built in. And secondly, that it was better than to confiscate all Jewish property. After 1938, with the second state, it was much better and rational just to confiscate all Jewish property than to make such transfer agreements. But in the years from 33 to 38, the transfer agreement allowed roughly some 10,000 Jews a year to go to Palestine, very small number if it's the total Jews concerned, and they took with them what they had. And that, of course, laid really much of the actual economic basis for present-day Israel, still dates from this kind of transfer agreement. Another reason why 1938, an interesting one, the Nazis abrogated. By 1938, after the Palestine White Papers by Britain, Hitler no longer believed that a Jewish state would come about. Therefore, it wasn't worthwhile as a trading area. It was only worthwhile as a trading area for him if there was, of course, a chance for an independent Jewish state. But in 38, it certainly looked as if it would never come about, and therefore this was a British trading area, a sterling trading area, and it wasn't really for him at all worthwhile. Thus, it became much better to expel Jews in a state of utter destitution. Now, whatever we might say, therefore, about Nazi Jewish contacts, and a great deal of controversy rages about this kind of thing, it is still true that they were necessary for the Jews involved, for their emigration, that they broke a boycott, which was never really an effective boycott in the first place, and that indeed to Palestine, in the last resort, This was of substantial and indeed very great benefit, that we must say as well. These Zionist activities were looked upon by the rest of the Jews with displeasure. And therefore the Zionists remained isolated until they were forced, really, by Nazi pressure to join in the Reich for Treasure in this basically liberal and anti-Zionist body. They were forced to join it. One other remark I want to make in this regard, and that is the following, that the German Zionists which negotiated the transfer agreement with the Nazis were Zionists in the Buber tradition. The man who did it, Landauer, for example, was of a nationalist, and that it must be realized that all the German Zionists who were involved in these negotiations left Israel in dismay and disappointment by 1951. That I think is fairly important, that all of these Zionists were Buber-like Zionists, by nationals, who in the end disapproved of the State of Israel as it came about, disapproved of it wholeheartedly. And Landauer, who in Israel had been the leader of the second most important political party, the second most important political party, which was a peace party, left Israel in voluntary exile in 1951, and with him the whole group of German Zionists who were crucial in all of this in the 1930s. So that the Zionists involved, including Robert Welch, who lived in London, the Zionists involved here were not Jabotinsky people. They were not even people of a virulent Jewish nationalism. They were German Zionists, which were the background of the binational movement and the background of the kind of Palestine which Herzl had at one point, as you know, envisaged. This is, I think, extremely important for the future. That whole group left, with one exception. The one exception was Pinchas Rosen, Rosenblut is his maiden name, who became the justice minister under Ben-Gurion. But, and he is about the only one of that group who remained in the state of Israel. The rest all left it. The Zionists, even so, were not welcome in the Reichsvertretung. And the hostility between Zionists on the one hand and the vast majority of Jews, liberal as I have said, and all that, on the other hand, that hostility lasts, that hostility will go throughout the rest of Europe. In every country, as the Nazis advance, you have this kind of split. On the one hand, the majority, liberal, on the other hand, the Zionists, a small minority trying accommodation. I shall go on with this next time.